also would like to thank the organizers. It's a great pleasure and an honor to be able to speak here and to be present at this meeting. So this talk will be about graphs and buildings, and it will be very much in the theme of this, what I take to be the theme of this conference, the contemplation of and really the reverence for geometrical objects with a very high degree of symmetry. So the objects that I'm going to be talking about are graphs. I'll use Greek letters for a graph. And usual letter big G for some fixed order morphism group, fixed subgroup of the order morphism group of this graph. And then we have the most important definition that we'll start with is the notion of a generalized polygon. So we say that gamma is a generalized polygon if a couple of things hold. Gamma has to be bipartite. The other condition is that the girth, in other words, the length of a shortest circuit in this graph gamma, is equal to the diameter times 2. So the diameter just refers to the natural distance between two vertices, the minimal number of edges that you need to get from one to the other. And this diameter is usually denoted by n, in which case we talk about a generalized n-gon. And when n is a small number, like 3, then we talk about generalized triangles. If n is 4, we talk about generalized quadrangles, and so on. So what does a generalized polygon really look like? Well, it's a bipartite graph, so we can draw it like this. And if we look at the case n equals 2, well, we can ask how does this look? We take two vertices on the same side of this bipartite graph, and since they're on the same side of a bipartite graph, the distance between these two vertices is even, because any path would have to go back and forth. But the diameter is 2, so the distance must just be an even number less than or equal to 2. It must be 2. So that means that we have a path like this. But this means, let's do it this way. Let's take two vertices on different sides of this graph, rather. So now we know, since the two vertices are on different sides of this graph, the distance has to be odd, but it has to be an odd number less than or equal to 2. So the distance is 1. In other words, an arbitrary vertex here is adjacent to an arbitrary vertex here, and we just have a complete bipartite graph. So this isn't very interesting. So in general, in fact, we'll assume that this number n is at least equal to 3. So what does a generalized triangle look like? Now we'll pick two vertices on the same side of this graph. And again, we argue that the distance has to be an even number between these two vertices, but it's an even number less than or equal to 3. So now we realize that there has to be a vertex over here, which is adjacent to both. And this leads us to the idea of regarding this bipartite graph as the incidence graph or the Levy graph of a geometry. In other words, we simply declare that these vertices are points and these vertices are lines. This gives us a geometry. And what we've just observed is that through any two points, it passes a line. And what's more, this line is unique because if there were a second line, which also passes through these same two points, then you would see a circuit of length 4, but the diameter of this graph is 2 times 3, it's 6. So this fourth circuit doesn't exist. In other words, through every two points, passes a unique line, but by the same argument, any two lines intersect in a unique point. So what you see is simply the incidence graph of a projective plane. And in fact, the notion of a generalized polygon, a generalized triangle, and a projective plane are equivalent notions. So this shows that the class of generalized polygons is a very rich class of graphs, almost too rich. So the theme of this conference is symmetry. We all know that there are just projective planes that have absurd, uninteresting automorphism groups. So we want to impose a condition on our generalized polygon, some kind of a symmetry condition. And the symmetry condition that I'm going to talk about is introduced by Jacques Titz, and it's called the Mouffant condition. And to begin with, I'll just pull this out of a hat, and then I'll say things about the Titz's motivation later on. So what does the Mouffant condition say? It says that for each path of length n, a sequence of n plus 1 vertices, each adjacent to the next. We look at the stabilizer of this n path, but not just the stabilizer, we look at the subgroup of G, which fixes every vertex on this path and every vertex at distance 1, at most 1 from this path. So in a picture, if I can just draw this with n equals 4, this path looks like this. And the stabilizer is the pointwise stabilizer of all the vertices that I've drawn in this picture. And then the Mouffant condition says that for all n paths, this subgroup must act transitively on the set of neighbors of xn, excluding xn minus 1. So again, in this picture, if this is x0, x1, xn, then xn has neighbors, and this subgroup must act transitively here. This is the Mouffant condition. And the theorem that gets this started is the following. This is a theorem of Titz and myself. It says the following. Suppose that gamma is an arbitrary connected graph. Not necessarily a generalized polygon. And suppose n is some number at least equal to 3. And suppose that we have this Mouffant condition. So notice that this Mouffant condition can be stated for an arbitrary group acting on an arbitrary graph. It has nothing to do with the notion of a generalized polygon. So I'll just write it again quickly. For each path of length n, this subgroup acts transitively on the set of neighbors of xn, with xn minus 1 excluded. And the second condition is that, again, for each path of length n, we assume that this is the group that fixes x0, x1, and every neighbor of x0 and every neighbor of x1 intersected with the stabilizer of this n path. We assume that this group is trivial. And then the theorem says that n can only assume certain very restricted values. And this is without any assumption on the graph gamma, so it's important to be emphasized. And we're also, I should emphasize here that we're also not assuming that anything is finite. So gamma might be infinite, the valency of gamma might be infinite. In fact, the valencies of gamma, the valencies of different vertices might be different as well. So it's clear that from this condition that the group G acts transitively on the edges of this graph, so there are most two different valencies, but we're not assuming either that these two valencies are the same. So in particular, gamma could be a tree, for example, which emphasizes how little role the graph itself actually plays in this theorem. But the result is that n can only assume these values. So the antecedent, the famous antecedent of this theorem, is the theorem that Marsden talked about yesterday of Tutte. Tutte proved 30 years earlier than this was proved that if gamma is finite and trivalent and S transitive, well, let me write it this way, N plus 1 transitive, then N can only assume the values 2, 3, and 4. So here we see a couple of more values. These two theorems, they look quite similar, and in fact, Tutte's theorem can be deduced from this theorem. This is a generalization. If gamma is trivalent, then notice that, for example, this group is just the stabilizer of the n-path, because if the graph is trivalent, and you fix x0, x1, x2, well, x1 only has one other neighbor, so it's automatically fixed. And so on. So this group really is just the stabilizer of x0 up to xn. And so in particular, if we have n plus 1 transitivity, we have this Mouffant condition, and it's not hard to deduce that also condition 2 holds as well. So Tutte's theorem, well, what this theorem tells you is that n has to be 3, 4, 6, or 8, but it's not difficult then in the trivalent case to eliminate 6 and 8. And in fact, this theorem was preceded by Tutte's theorem, but also the proof was a modification of earlier work on Tutte's theorem. So what is the connection between this theorem and Mufang polygons? Well, in a Mufang polygon, it's almost just an exercise to show that condition 2 holds as well. And so the theorem says that, as a corollary, that Mufang n-gons exist only for these values n equals 3, 4, 6, and 8. So this is to be viewed as one generalization of this famous result, famous and extremely original result of Tutte. So Tutte's theorem has been generalized in many different ways, but this is the generalization that I would like to talk about today. Here I should emphasize that Tutte's theorem and all the other generalizations of Tutte's theorem to graphs of higher valency, to locally transitive graphs and amalgam problems, all these kinds of things, all depend heavily on the fact that the graph gamma is finite. Actually, it doesn't. These results don't depend on gamma being finite. They really depend on the stabilizer of a vertex and G being finite. But essentially, it's the same thing. And this finite is crucial here. So, in particular, if we eliminate the finiteness, then this theorem is completely false. Whereas this theorem continues to hold. So in this theorem, finiteness is not assumed. No other kind of finite. The only thing that's finite in this problem, in this theorem, is the value of this number n. So why is this my favorite generalization of Tutte's theorem? Well, because this theorem has as an application it opens the door to the classification of Mufang polygons. So if you want to classify Mufang polygons, you apply this theorem and you discover that there only are four different cases to be considered, n equals 3, 4, 6, and 8. So the problem is broken down into four subproblems. We just need to classify Mufang triangles, in other words, Mufang projective planes, Mufang quadrangles, Mufang hexagons, and Mufang octagons. So this classification then was carried out by Tutte and myself, and let me just say a few words about how the classification works. So if we start with the case n equals 3, this is the classic case. So these are Mufang projective planes. And the way the classification works is that you use the geometry that you're given with this displaying a high degree of symmetry captured by this Mufang property to coordinatize this projective plane. So somehow you introduce coordinates. But introducing coordinates, you also have to introduce some kind of an algebraic system which serves somehow as the parameter system in this coordinatization. And the algebraic structure that arises when you do this coordinatization are it's the notion of an alternative division ring. And in fact, it's the connection between projective planes and alternative division rings which was studied by Ruth Mufang in the 1930s. Ruth Mufang didn't know anything about generalized polygons. This is a notion introduced by Tutte, but he called this notion this condition the Mufang condition, just to honor Ruth Mufang. He had a very cordial and friendly relationship with her and had great admiration for her. And so in the case n equals 3, this really was the work of Mufang, just to examine this connection between projective planes and alternative division rings. And in the 1930s, so this goes both ways. So basically Mufang triangles or Mufang projective planes are classified by alternative division rings. And so this sort of sets the patterns. If you want to look at the geometrical object of a Mufang projective plane, the classification reduces to an algebraic question. What are the alternative division rings? And this became a subject of lively interest in the 1930s and even into the 1950s. And people like Artin and so on worked on the problem of trying to classify these alternative division rings. The classification was finally completed by Brook and Kleinfeld in the early 1950s, and the result is that an alternative division ring is either a field or a skew field, or one exceptional non-associative object, an Artonian division algebra. And so this completes the classification because, I mean, again, you can't, at a certain point you have to stop. You can't classify skew fields. But the point is that projective plane satisfying the Mouffant conditions are classified by an object in this class of algebraic objects in a certain way. In other words, given one of these objects, you can produce the corresponding projective plane. Two projective planes are isomorphic if and only if the corresponding field of parameters are isomorphic fields and so on. So this really classifies these projective planes. And this is typical pattern. So there's a geometric part and then an algebraic part of this classification. And quite typically, the algebraic part is by far the more difficult part. This was a difficult classification to carry out. And even when it was finally completed by Brook and Kleinfeld, they first had to exclude characteristic 2 and then come back and develop other methods to look at characteristic 2. And now we understand the proof much better, and you can do this characteristic 3. Nevertheless, okay, n equals 4, that's too complicated, I won't say anything. N equals 6, these are classified by certain Jordan algebras, which I also don't want to talk about, but generalized octagons, here I can say more easily what's going on. So these are classified by pairs of objects. I just have to tell you what these two objects are. So K is a field, just an ordinary field, commutative field, but it has to be in characteristic 2. And sigma is what's called a Kitz endomorphism of K. So sigma is an endomorphism of K, not necessarily an automorphism, just an additive multiplicative map, but not necessarily surjective. And this has to be have the property that if you do it twice, you get the Frobenius map. In other words, if you take an arbitrary element in K and apply sigma and then apply sigma again, then you have to get x squared. This is called a Kitz endomorphism simply because of these rows in this context. And Mouffant octagons are simply classified by such pairs. Again, if you're given two such pairs, then the corresponding octagons are isomorphic exactly when there's an isomorphism from the one field to the other, which carries the Kitz endomorphism in the one pair to the Kitz endomorphism of the other pair. So in particular, there's no restriction on the structure of K. It could be something very complicated with many transcendentals. And so, in particular, a given field might have many of these Kitz endomorphisms, and you'll get a different Mouffant octagon for each of these pairs. So this, modulo some lack of clarity here, this is describes the classification of Mouffant endgons. Okay, but then, now the topic of this talk is building, so let me now try to say something about the connection between Mouffant polygons and buildings. So we'll start a fresh chapter here. So I want to talk now about buildings. So buildings, historically, they were originally viewed as a kind of polytope, but a polytope without the diamond condition. So these are thick polytopes. But in fact, subsequently, it was noticed, observed, that buildings can be viewed simply as a class of graphs. And as such, that it's much easier to understand what's going on. So let me try to give you the definition. So to talk about a building, you first have to talk about Coxeter groups. But to this audience, I don't have to say very much. So you start with an arbitrary Coxeter diagram like this, and we let I be the set of vertices. And we all know how this produces a Coxeter group, but not just the Coxeter group, but the Coxeter group with a distinguished class of generators, one for each vertex of the Coxeter diagram. And whenever we have a group and a distinguished set of generators, especially a distinguished set of generators, each of order 2, then what's more obvious than to look at the corresponding Cayley graph. So this is the corresponding Cayley graph. And has also been observed several times in this meeting already, this Cayley graph has a natural edge color. So in fact, we want to regard this Cayley graph as being an edge color graph. So I not only is the set of vertices of the Coxeter diagram, but it's also this, at the same time, it's our set of colors. We're going to think of I as a set of colors. And sigma is a graph whose edges are colored in a natural way by the generators of I. And it's colored in such a way that if you pick an arbitrary vertex, then there's exactly one edge of each color emanating from that vertex. Good. So now what is a building? So a building, when you talk about a building, you have to specify Coxeter diagrams. So a building has a type, and the type of the building is the Coxeter diagram you have in mind. So a building of type, and here you fill in your favorite Coxeter diagram. So like this, maybe a building of type is an edge color graph. So again, I remains the set of colors, where I is the set of vertices here. So you can imagine, if you like, you can think of the Coxeter diagram as having colored vertices, but then the building has colored edges with the same colors. So this is a set of colors. And then we have some axioms, just as you'd expect. So, but these axioms are actually quite simple. So the first axiom is, I could tell you the axiom, or I could tell you the definition first. Let me give you a definition. So whenever you have an arbitrary edge-colored graph, then you have a notion of a residue. So what is a residue? You pick some set of colors. So you pick subset of the colors, your favorite subset, and you pick an arbitrary vertex in this graph, and then you just the corresponding J residue is the subgraph that you get by taking this vertex and all the vertices that you can reach just using J-colored edges, and that subgraph. So it's a connected graph by definition, and it only has edges whose colors lie in the set J. So this is a J residue. So another way to put this is if you pick a subset of the colors and you put on special glasses that only see the colors in the set J, and you look at the graph, and the connected components that you see, those are the J residues of this graph. So it's a general notion that you can talk about with an arbitrary edge-colored graph. So if this is a coloring in the classical sense, in the sense of chromatic number and so on, then the J residues would just be single edges. But this is just the opposite. So this is not a coloring in that sense. And the J residues won't be single edges in general. So here at the J residues are just single. If I pick for J a single color, rather, then the J residues are just the edges, some edges. Like that. Good. So the first axiom says as follows. We start at an arbitrary vertex, and we pick a color, so red. And we go on a red edge, and then we go on another red edge. So this is red, and this is red. So this is legal. You can have two red edges meeting at the same place. But when this happens, there has to be a third red edge, like this. And so another a fancy way to say this is that if you pick for J a subset with one color, then the corresponding residue has to be a complete graph. If you go two steps, then you have to be able to have gone on a shortcut like this. And even more, I put this in the same place, and all one-colored residues are complete graphs. That's just a restatement of what I just said, with at least two vertices. So another way to say this is that at every vertex, for each color, there really has to be at least one edge that emanates from that vertex of that color. That's the law. And then the next says the following. Every two vertices lie on an edge, lie on an apartment. So what is an apartment? An apartment is simply a subgraph of this building. Let me give a name to the building. So the building is a graph, so I'll use a Greek letter, delta. So what is an apartment? An apartment is a subgraph of delta, but now delta is an edge-colored graph, so when I speak of subgraph, I really mean as an edge-colored graph. So an apartment, by definition, is any subgraph isomorphic to this sigma. So remember, we have a fixed Coxeter diagram. That fixed Coxeter diagram gives rise to this fixed edge-colored Cayley graph. And a building will, of this type will have many, many subgraphs. By definition, all color isomorphic to this sigma. And these subgraphs, they're called apartments. And the second axiom says that there's so many of these apartments that any two vertices lie on an apartment. And since these apartments are connected graphs, this tells us in particular that delta is a connected graph. And then the third axiom and the last axiom says that apartments are convex. Just in the ordinary sense of the word, so a convex as a set of vertices. So if this is an apartment in this graph, I just take any two vertices and I pick a minimal path, a path of minimal length that goes from the one vertex to the other. That path has to lie entirely inside the apartment. So that's convex in the obvious sense of the word. And this is it. This is the entire definition of a building. So let's think of some examples of a building. So the first example is just a single apartment. So we can just take the Cayley graph of this Coxeter diagram. And then this condition holds because in this case the one colored residues are simply edges. And the edges are complete graphs and they have at least two vertices. And the other two axioms then are simply vacuous. So the Cayley graph of a Coxeter diagram is in fact an example of a building, but it's in some sense not an interesting one. So we always eliminate this by also demanding that the building be thick. So by thick we simply say at least three vertices here, just to eliminate that example. So now we need an example of a thick building. So I won't use the adjective thick anymore. There are lots of adjectives that I'll need to use in a moment. So I won't say thick, but I'm assuming that these buildings are thick. So each of these one-colored residues are complete graphs with at least three vertices. But it's also to be emphasized that in most of the examples, these residues are infinite. They'll have, at each vertex, there'll be infinitely many red edges and infinitely many blue edges. Right. So, we need an example. So we start small. So here's the simplest Coxeter diagram. So what does a building of this type look like? Well, in this case, there's only one color. And so the entire graph just has one color, and we know that it just consists of its red residue. And red, all residues, all one-colored residues are complete graphs. So in this case, vacuously, delta is just a complete graph. And this is, in fact, a small defect in the theory of buildings. So the theory of buildings, it comes from, we're going to explain in a second how this notion comes from the theory of groups, and those groups whose corresponding building is of rank one. So the rank of a building is the number of colors, or the number of vertices in its Coxeter diagram. And those groups whose building is of rank one, the theory of buildings doesn't say too much. Okay, so what does rank two look like? So a rank two diagram looks like this. And so what does gamma look like? Well, the corresponding Coxeter group here is just a dihedral group of order 2n, and so this is just a 2n circuit. And we can call the two colors black and white. And so this is a 2n circuit, and every other edge is black, and every other edge is white. And then what does the corresponding building look like? Well, the corresponding building is exactly a generalized n-gon. But then, wait a second, what do I mean by this? So a generalized n-gon is a bipartite graph. The corresponding building is not the generalized n-gon gamma, it's the edge graph. So this is the edge graph of the generalized n-gon, as I've described up there. So by edge graph, I mean it's the graph whose vertices are the edges of gamma, and the edge graph of a bipartite graph comes naturally with a coloring. The edges are naturally colored by black and white. Think about it. So gamma is a bipartite graph. I just call this block of vertices black, and I call this white. And then when I have an edge in delta, those are two edges of gamma. An edge here is a pair of edges here that, that meet in a vertex. And that vertex will either be on this side or on this side. So the edges come naturally colored black and white. And what does a black residue look like? Well, if I start with a vertex in delta, and I pick a color, say black, then all the vertices that are in a delta, which are black adjacent to this one, they all look like this. And of course, they're all black adjacent to each other, so they're forming a complete graph. So that's where this first condition comes from. And then the second condition, that every two vertices lies on an apartment, well, that corresponds, you have to think a little bit about the details, but that corresponds to the fact that the diameter of this graph is just n. This is a 2n path, and since the circuit, and since the diameter is just n, you can deduce from that, or show that it's in fact equivalent to this axiom that every two vertices lie in an apartment. And the fact that apartments are convex corresponds in a similar fashion to the fact that the circuits of length 2n in a generalized n-gon, those are the circuits of minimal length. So you can easily show that that's equivalent to the convexity of apartments. So in fact, a building whose type is this, this category of graphs really corresponds one-to-one, in a one-to-one way, to the category of generalized n-gons. So in other words, with the classification of Mu-Funk polygons, what we've done is classified buildings of this type with this Mu-Funk property. So now what do we do? Well, now at this point we have to specialize. So this is the notion of a building. It's a little bit too general. So there are we can talk about buildings starting with an arbitrary Coxeter diagram. But there's very little that we can say in complete generality. One important observation is the following, that if you take any subset of the colors, J, that's some subset of the vertices of this diagram, and that set will span a subdiagram. And one property of a building is that all the J residues will themselves be buildings. And in order to talk about a building, I have to tell you what the type is. Well, the type of a J residue is exactly the subdiagram that's spanned by the vertices in your set J of the diagram of the building delta. So the theory of buildings is inductive in this sense. So if we have a building with this diagram, we see that there are many subbuildings which are generalized triangles, and there are many subbuildings which are generalized quadrangles, and then there are some subbuildings which are generalized digons corresponding to this subset, big J. So this inductive hypothesis is important, but there aren't too many deep statements that can be made in complete generality. So, but historically, the special case that interested Titz the most were the spherical buildings. So we say that delta is spherical if this Coxeter group, or equivalently this Cayley graph, is finite. Since there are lots of things in this business that could be called finite, Titz preferred to use the word spherical rather than finite, because the graphs themselves are not finite. What this means is, since the apartments are finite, and every two vertices lies on an apartment, you can deduce easily that the diameter is finite, but we're not assuming that the valencies are finite, so these are still infinite graphs in general. And his most famous result from the 1970s was that the classification of spherical buildings. But we have to put some adjectives in here to make this statement accurate. So what he really classified were thick spherical buildings, but I've agreed not to say thick. And the other adjective that we need here is irreducible. So what does irreducible mean? Well, a building is irreducible if this Coxeter diagram is connected. And this is a harmless hypothesis, because if this diagram is not connected, then it's easy to show that the building that you're thinking of is in some natural and elementary way a direct product of two smaller buildings. So in other words, disconnected Coxeter diagram leads to a decomposition, and you can just study the different components one at a time. So it's really harmless to assume irreducibility, but it's important to put it here just to make it clear what Pitts did. And the other thing that he did was, so he classified irreducible spherical buildings of rank of these three. So as we've observed, a spherical building of rank two is just the same thing as a generalized polygon. Generalized polygons include all projective planes, so classification is not in the cards. The situation is simply too wild in the case of rank two. But as soon as the rank is larger, then classification not only becomes possible, but Pitts actually carried this out. And the remarkable thing is that the spherical buildings that then arise all display a high degree of symmetry. And this high degree of symmetry is captured by this Mufang property. So in particular, this notion of a Mufang generalized polygon can be generalized to the notion of a Mufang spherical building in general. And what he showed is that an arbitrary spherical building has this Mufang property. So what exactly the Mufang property for in higher rank says isn't important. The important thing is that he observed in particular that the residues, no, the irreducible residues. So remember now, a residue, to talk about a residue, you pick a subset J, and we call the residue irreducible if the subgraph, the subdiagram that's spanned by J is a connected graph. So the irreducible residues of rank two, so these are certain generalized polygons, are Mufang. So the original proof that, so Pitts proved this classification many years before he, before the classification of Mufang polygons. So when the original classification was carried out, it was carried out even though he was aware of this, or this notion of Mufang was dawning on him, he didn't use this fact in any way. So, but what he did prove, so the crucial lemma that enabled Pitts to carry out this classification says the following, that delta under these hypotheses is uniquely determined by its irreducible rank two residues containing a single chamber vertex. So you pick an arbitrary vertex, here's our Coxeter diagram. So we pick an arbitrary vertex. Let's name the colors maybe red, white, and green. And then what we see is that there are red, white, on this vertex X of the graph delta, there's a unique red, white residue. Here it is. And there's a unique white, green residue. Here it is. So this is the red, white residue. And here's the white, green residue. And of course, there's a bit of an overlap here. These are all this is the white residue. These are all the vertices that you can reach from X just going along a white edge. And this is a small subgraph of the whole building. And the theorem says that the whole building is uniquely determined just by this little substructure. So if you had a second building and a second vertex, and you did this as well, and if you had some isomorphism from this little thing to this little thing, it would automatically extend to an isomorphism of the two buildings. And this is a remarkable fact. It could be exploited cleverly in the case that this building and this building are the same, but at different vertices. So you kind of can apply this theorem to build up the automorphism group of delta. And this is the idea. So you apply this lemma in a very clever fashion over and over, and you reach the conclusion that the automorphism group of delta is big. And in particular, you have this fact, and then you do things. But in the original proof, it was published in 1974. What you did at this point then was relatively ad hoc, because Pitts didn't have control of the rank two residues. So this theorem says that the rank two residues are crucial. They're somehow the the things that determine the structure, and yet he didn't know what the structure of the rank two residues were. He had to start at rank three, so to speak, and argue in an ad hoc fashion in certain cases, and do things with one hand tied behind his back in some sense. But then once the classification of Mufang polygons was complete, the situation changed, and so a second generation proof could be given of this classification. Where the classification in the second generation proof goes is, well, things work inductively, so you really only have to concentrate on the rank three case. In rank three, there only are, we know from Coxeter's original classification, there only are two spherical Coxeter diagrams in rank three. The one is called A3 and the other one is called B3 or C3. And so what you see here is, in this case, you have one projective plane and here's another projective plane, and you have to see how they, you take two projective planes, but you know these two projective planes are Mufang, so you're really taking two alternative division rings, and then you try to see whether you can fit them together to form one of these objects inside of a spherical building. This goes in a couple of minutes. This is by far the more difficult problem. Why? Because I purposely didn't say anything about the case n equals 4. So most Mufang polygons are Mufang quadrangles. It's the most complicated case to describe. There's the greatest variety of these things, and they're the most ferocious to understand. So the algebraic structures that arise as parameter systems for Mufang quadrangles are quite complicated and subtle. And you have to go through a kind of a longer list in order to carry out the classification of these things. But still, even in this case, the proof only takes 10 or 20 pages. And it goes in a very beautiful fashion. So what you're essentially doing, you can kind of imagine that you have the classification of Mufang polygons at your disposal. So you can think of this as a bag full of polygons made out of plastic, and you reach in, you take out a Mufang quadrangle and you take out a Mufang triangle, and you try to fit them together. There are certain rules that have to be obeyed for them to be able to fit together like this, and most of the time they just don't fit and you throw them away. And then every now and then you take one out, and you can almost hear a satisfying click as they fit together, and then you put this on your shelf of beautiful geometric objects to contemplate, and you go on in this fashion, and in about 20 pages at most you're finished with the classification. So pardon me? The idea is the situation you're in is that you have this hypothetical building, and you want to, you're just trying to classify, not construct at this moment. Construction is another question that I won't say anything about. So you have a hypothetical building. You're just trying to pin it down, and you know it's uniquely determined as soon as you know these two things. But if I just take any quadrangle and any triangle, they won't in general fit together. There are certain rules that will be violated. But there's a short list of necessary and sufficient conditions on how these things fit together. And you just have to calculate your way through all the various families, subfamilies of Mufang quadrangles, basically, to carry out the classification. So let me see, some remarks about this. So now I can also explain Titz's motivation in how he came up with this rather remarkable Mufang condition. If you compare the Mufang condition with all the efforts that were made previously to generalize Tutte's theorem, you see that somehow it's somehow the right condition, because it just works much better, and it works without any restriction on finiteness in any regard. So how did Titz find this condition? Well, his motivation for developing the theory of buildings came from the fact that he knew the examples really well. So he was really an expert in algebraic groups. And it was the structure of the algebraic groups, in particular the structure of the exceptional groups, that he was trying to axiomatize. In particular, the existence of the exceptional groups had only been proved in an ad hoc fashion up until then. And his idea was that somehow all the simple algebraic groups could be accounted for in one grand scheme, and this led to the notion of a building. And he observed in particular that the buildings that are naturally associated with a simple algebraic group, it took him a while to notice this, but he gradually noticed that they all have this Mufang condition. The other reason that he introduced the Mouffant condition is that he realized that he could prove that this theorem implied that his buildings of higher rank have this Mouffant condition, and more importantly, that all the rank two residues have this Mouffant condition. And why was he so interested in this? Well, because in the original classification, so this was from 1974, but not quite, so that when he published the classification of these irreducible spherical buildings of rank at least three in 1974, there was a blemish in the proof. So he couldn't deal with the Coxeter diagrams, the spherical Coxeter diagrams, H3 and H4, which have played such a big role in this, in various talks in this meeting. So there are no algebraic groups giving rise to buildings whose type is H3 or H4. He knew this, so he assumed that there were no thick buildings. So there are thin buildings of type H3 and H4. In other words, there are Coxeter diagrams and there are these Cayley graphs, but he conjectured that there were no thick buildings, and he was right, but he didn't have a proof at this time. So he just omitted these two cases. But then in the appendix to this book in 1974, this notion of a Mouffant polygon was just being formed in his mind, and his principal goal was to get rid of, to solve this case. So the logic is as follows. So now we know, we have a proof that there are no thick buildings of type H3 and H4. So here's how the proof goes. Suppose we had a building whose type is H3. Well, then all irreducible residues of rank 2 are Mouffant. So there would be a Mouffant pentagon. But by the theorem that I erased on the blackboard right here, he was able to prove that, well, originally all he proved was that Mouffant n-gons don't exist for n equals 5. And with this, he could eliminate H3 and H4. So that was his principal motivation. But in proving that Mouffant pentagons didn't exist, he saw that there was more going on than that, and he conjectured that, in fact, they exist only for these limited values of n, and then he came on the conjecture that, in fact, maybe you could actually classify generalized polygons with this Mouffant condition, and that this would lead to this second generation proof of the classification, and this is exactly what was eventually realized. And then maybe one more word. So this classification doesn't assume finiteness, and this leads also to the fact that these algebraic structures can be quite complicated. But of course, if you're only interested in finite buildings, well, what are the finite buildings that come out of this classification? These are precisely all the buildings that are associated with finite groups of Lie type. In other words, almost all finite simple groups are in one-to-one correspondence with a certain building. And what does the classification look like? Well, you can go through Titz's classification and then see what happens with each of these kinds of algebraic structures if you, in addition, assume finiteness. So if the building is finite, also this algebraic structure will have to be finite. It's if and only if. And so you just go through here and you say, well, Wedderburn said something about this. And in fact, our team proved that there are none of these in the finite case, and so on. So what about in this case? In this case, well, the field's characteristic 2, so we know that for each prime power there exists a unique field, and then we need this Titz endomorphism, and it's an elementary exercise to see that in fact M must be an odd number, and when M is an odd number, then there's exactly one of these endomorphisms. So in the finite case, you get exactly one octagon for every odd power of 2. But by doing a little bit of extra algebra on the various algebraic structures that arise. And you can go through the whole thing and just pick out the finite ones in the same fashion. You can also go through and pick out all those that are defined over a local field. This turns out, this leads to the whole theory of affine buildings, which is another story, but this is a major theme in modern number theory. And then the one remark I'd like to make in closing is here's the definition of a building, and what I'd like to emphasize is that in this definition of a building, I mean, you see how simple it is. It's particularly simple for this audience because you all feel completely comfortable with the notion of a this Cayley graph. To another audience, maybe you have to think about it a little bit more, what's going on, but this is a pretty elementary definition. I hope this makes it clear that the theory of buildings is really just a branch of graph theory, in fact, extremely colorful and attractive branch of graph theory. But what I want to emphasize here is that there's nothing in the definition about a group. So here there's sort of a group, but of course you could define this graph purely combinatorial. It's a kind of a universal cover or something. I mean, you people know better how to do this than I do. So this is really just a combinatorial object. So in particular, in a generalized N-gon, the apartments are a circuit. So of course the circuit has a big automorphism group. But we're not saying in this definition anything about the automorphisms of the building itself. And as we've seen, a building could be a special case, or just it's just a projective plane. There exist projective planes with trivial automorphism group. So it's really to be emphasized that there's nothing about the group here. And yet, in Titz's big theorem, when the rank at least is at least equal to 3, this thing is forced to have. So that just from these few simple axioms, you get a rich family of graphs that are forced to have very highly enormous automorphism groups that display very, very high degree of symmetry, which is very beautiful to contemplate. So thank you very much.